Hello, everyone. Welcome to the city call on agricultural commodities. My name is Arkady Gevorkin, and let me first get out the disclosures. So this call is for city clients only, no media. And if you are the client that requires MiFID agreement in place, please get in touch with your rep and please disconnect from this call. Happy to host this call, and this is a very topical and exciting topic. So again, I'm part of the city commodities research. I'm covering all agricultural commodities, grain, oil seeds, corn, wheat, soy, and also on the soft side, I look at the coffee, cocoa, and sugar. Been with city for 6 years, and super exciting to host this call with the amazing panel that I'm about to introduce. So today we're joined with Gabriel Barra. Gabriel is the head of LATAM Equities Commodities. Gabriel joined Citi in 2021, but have been at in the business for some time. And in agribusiness, he focuses on sugar and ethanol players, some input businesses, and SLC, and on corn and soybean producers in Brazil. So, Gabriel, thanks for joining. Also, I'm joined by Patrick Cunningham, so who is the head of North American Chemicals and been with Citi for 5 years and focus on broad set of petrochemicals, specialty chemicals coverage within the ag space and focus on crop chemical seed business. And finally, so Patrick, welcome. And finally, Sebastian Satz. Sebastian is a head of EU chemicals research, joined Citi Research 2.5 years ago, but been in the industry for some time, for 20 years, over 20 years, and focus is on industrial and consumer chemicals, but also covers fertilizer stocks, and among others. So great to have you all, and looking forward to hearing from all of you corresponding kind of coverage, and because ag sector is quite topical, and yeah, it's a lot of things going on. So and partly driven by the major shifts that are happening in the commodities market and at the moment. So with that, let me kind of spend a few words speaking about the commodities market before switching to our esteemed panel. Recently, Citi Research updated the price forecast for major agricultural products and on the grain sides and softs, and we are structurally bullish. We're structurally bullish across pretty much all of them except of Arabica coffee, which we think could have some more downside before starting founding the floor, and hence are relatively bearish on Arabica coffee, but bullish on everything else. There are a set of factors or set of risks that are emerging and that are developing pretty rapidly that in our assessment would present a good buying opportunity or an entry point for majority of this agricultural products. And I'll walk through a few of those at the moment. So the one of the first bullish risks that we see is the fertilizer prices, and we'll speak about it with our equity research folks in a moment. But from what we see from the commodity standpoint is due to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, prolonged closure and uncertainty about how long will it stay closed, fertilizer prices, especially on nitrogen fertilizers, have increased 50 to 60% versus pre-conflict time. Fertilizer prices represent about 60% of the variable cost for farmers in the U.S., and it probably that share is significantly higher for farmers in the in Brazil and India, as labor costs are typically lower in terms of their share composition of the variable cost. So, and farmers in Brazil and India are being more price sensitive to these fluctuations and would likely under apply, in our opinion. So that presents a big risk for the yields for the next season. And when we talk about the seasons, every agricultural product has different calendar. So in the U.S., farmers are going underway, are going through the planting period, and about two-thirds has been already planted of corn and soybeans. I expect that in the next 2 weeks, we'll be learning more about farmers replanting from what they initially thought would be corn to soybeans because of the cost of the nitrogen type of fertilizers that are highly reliant on the flows from the Strait of Hormuz and increase in price much more than potassium type of fertilizers that are relevant for soybeans. Now, that's in the U.S., and that's kind of the projection there for less supply of corn. In Brazil, planting season will start in September for main crop on soybeans and for the small crop on corn. And farmers are actually now, starting now, are being active in procuring, trying to source their fertilizers as they need it ahead of the planting season. The broader expectation is they probably would be short on their application. But now the fertilizer risk is really hard to quantify because it really depends on the weather and what type of weather will be happening in the next 6 to 12 months. If the weather is cooperative and is relatively good, at the time when you under apply fertilizers, the drop in yields could be less significant or not absent at all. However, if there is a situation when you have a bad weather and under applied fertilizers, that creates a perfect storm scenario, especially for major grains. Now, in our view, this risk is very underappreciated and downplayed, I would say. I don't think that the fertilizer prices are coming down, even if the Strait of Hormuz will reopen tomorrow. I do think that there will be a more sustained, higher price environment, at least for the next 6 months before the whole system kind of comes back to normality and normalizes. Having said that, the sensitive groups or sensitive regions rather to this risk is Brazil and India, as those two regions are highly dependent on the fertilizer flows from Middle East. While others, including in the U.S., even with the government subsidies, will end up paying a slightly higher price on the fertilizer use. The second risk that I see is developing is the blending requirements. And this is something that have been there in place and probably more relevant for sugar, corn, and soybeans, as those agricultural products are heavily utilized or can be used in the energy complex. Before the conflict started, and even after the conflict, we started learning about some new of the blending requirements and mandates. In the U.S., the most recent bill that was passed by the House is having year-round E15 or ethanol blend at 15%, which will be which has been discussed for a long time and had a long history reviewing, but we don't necessarily know exactly whether that will pass the Senate or not. But if it does, that will create another bullish setup for corn, as this is typically used for blending in the U.S. In Brazil, the government articulated this target from E30 to E32, which will be beneficial for both corn and sugar, as both of those are being used for ethanol production. And few other countries, Vietnam, Guatemala, right, that are starting to look at and introduce this blending requirement. So overall, we see this as another factor that will drive the demand for the agricultural products. And finally, in terms of the bullish risks, to top it off with the weather, is strong El Nino and El Nino patterns that are currently developing and projection by the NOAA of the over 90% likelihood of having El Nino, about over 60% likelihood of having a strong El Nino, which could put us as the base case somewhere between strong and moderate El Nino, at least as the kind of worst case scenario, it could be a record El Nino, record severe El Nino, which would be associated with the highest degree of temperatures increase in the Pacific Ocean. El Nino typically comes with the abnormal weather patterns where you have drought type of scenarios in India, Southeast Asia, and you have excessive levels of precipitation in South America. So, but here I'm showing the chart on the right is agricultural yields for sugar, which fluctuate. And you can see that India and Thailand during the darker red, which represents a strong El Nino, the last one was 2015, 2016, and then moderate El Nino in 23, 24, the agricultural yields have actually fallen. And if we look at the total supply in India, that collapsed by about 30%. Which made India to be a net importer and start going actively into the global markets and buy sugar. In terms of the El Nino risk, I would rank cocoa as being the most exposed to this risk because of the where the main areas of concentration for production of cocoa is. And in the past, in 23-24, there were very strong Harmattan winds that created this structural supply destruction and loss of a significant share of the Ivory Coast and Ghana production. Ecuador is also very much exposed in terms of the cocoa supply. And with the strong El Nino in the past 30 years, we've seen evidence when there is a fall in that. So cocoa would be in the first place, but sugar will be on the second. And we do have an open trade recommendation, which is highlighted in this report as well, coal spread and sugar. We think that the sugar is relatively cheap and there is an upside potential for that, given that it's exposed to all three of these risks, being needed fertilizers, needed being used in the blending requirements, and also El Nino, which, as is projected to come in June, July, would have a large impact during the monsoon season in India and Thailand and would create a low level of precipitation, which could be quite significant for the agricultural yields down the road. With that kind of a broad overview, and I see that there are already a few questions coming in on the commodity side, but let me first give a chance for the panel to have an opening remarks about their coverage and how they see kind of the current environment shaping before switching to the Q&A. So probably we can start with Gabriel, since kind of I finished on the Brazil note and the sugar. That could be a good segue in that discussion. So Gabriel, over to you.
Thanks, Arkad. Thanks, everyone. So I think that there are three main topics here on my coverage in agribusiness. I think that we can start with sugar and ethanol. And as Arkad mentioned about the sector, and we have been more bullish on sugar, and in my point of view and our point of view, it totally makes sense given the scenario that it's we have for the remainder of this year, right? If you take a look on the ethanol, I think that the main point right now that I have discussed with clients here is that on sugar and ethanol have been neutral for most of the companies that we cover. And the main point is not about sugar, but mostly on ethanol, right? If you take a look on the current trend of ethanol price in the domestic market in Brazil, we are seeing a really fast deterioration in the price given the scenario for this crop season, which means that in the beginning of this crop, most of the players, they are targeted to increase their ethanol production given the profitability that they have in ethanol against sugar. So if you take a look on the chart, I think that Arkad has in the presentation that was released yesterday with the update, the profitability of ethanol in comparison of sugar have dropped drastically in the beginning of the crop season. So the main question mark right now is that how this is going to to behave in the remain of this crop season. So what he said about ethanol, it's an important factor. So right now in Brazil, we are discussing about increasing our ethanol mix, our ethanol blend into gasoline to something close to 32%, which could represent a 1 to 2 billion additional demand for ethanol. However, I would say that we always talk about ethanol in two different ways, one in a micro discussion and one in a macro discussion. In a micro discussion right now, when we talk about the supply demand in Brazil, it seems that with the E32 and with a higher supply, we are, let's say, more balanced, right? But on the macro perspective, despite the fact that we have higher oil price, we have two important variables in this equation that's not in favor of a higher ethanol price in the short term. The first one is gasoline price in Brazil. Remember that in Brazil, different from US, we have 100% ethanol at pump, so we can use ethanol in our passenger fleet cars that we have here, that it's almost 90% of our fleet in Brazil. So we can choose between gasoline, that's E30 right now, or 100% ethanol at pump. So there is a kind of correlation between gasoline and ethanol at the pump, which translates to the ethanol producer price. So if gasoline price doesn't go up, and this is exactly what we are seeing today in Brazil, this does not represent an upside risk for ethanol price in the end of the day. The second point is its effects rate. Brazilian reais, we have seen the last year Brazilian reais coming from 5.5, 5.4 reais per dollar to close to 5 reais right now. So this, it's also a downside risk here for ethanol, domestic ethanol price in Brazil. So when put together, this challenge scenario for ethanol and sugar price not reacting to all of these fundamentals at this point, it has been really tough for us to be more positive in sugar and ethanol teas in Brazil. As an example, San Martin, that's one of the best players in the domestic market in Brazil. We still see a free cash flow, for example, below 5%. In a recurrent way, next year, if everything goes right in our forecast, this represents an upside risk. But at this point, we do not see this upside. So I think that the main question mark right now is how sugar is going to behave and how the mix in Brazil between ethanol and sugar is going to behave during this crop season. And all of this depends on weather, cost, and how the price is going to behave in mainly gasoline price in Brazil for now on. Lastly here, only going to, let's say, really fast here on grains and the other companies that we cover, that I could say that most important ones are SLC and Tritantos in this context that we are discussing today. SLC is a pretty play in the sector. They produce cotton.
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 V CN 20210130。
Soybean and corn. I have received a lot of questions about SLC recently, since the beginning of the war, since the end of February, on how this could translate into a higher free cash flow for the company. I agree with Akad in terms of pricing reacting positively to this high cost. If you take a look on this exchange rate between fertilizers and commodity price in Brazil have been quite tough for Brazilian producers. I think for this crop season in Brazil, the scenario, it's already in place. We know it's more clear the scenario for this year, for this crop season. Soybean, it's almost 100% harvest. The second crop for corn is already planted. Second crop for cotton, it's also planted. So the main question mark is the next crop season. So the main point right now is understand, and I think that Seb and Patrick could help us a lot here in terms of this discussion about supply of fertilizers, mainly on nitrogen fertilizer, right? So SOC is a good example. Right now they have not, they didn't buy nitrogen fertilizer at this point. So they still have time, and most of the farmers in Brazil, they still have time, as Akad mentioned, the crop season in Brazil, the next crop season starts by September, we need to have in place all the fertilizer that they need. But for corn, that's more important. They only plant corn during the summer, so after January, for example. So we still have time, but if the war prolongs, and have a tight market for fertilizer, this could be a problem, not only in terms of productivity, but in terms of cost for producers. So it's more uncertainty here on the thesis. And that said, if you take a look on the BRL, for example, in this context for SOC, it's more difficult. Okay. The company's leverage right now is more leveraged than the past and leverage in BRL. So the appreciation of BRL for them, it's negative. I want to finalize here. Our topic in the sector is Três Tentos. This input company verticalizing the sector. They have input business in the trading and the industrial business. So they are more, let's say that they're more hedged against all of these impacts that we're seeing in the sector right now. They're not so leveraged. They have a really good strategy to grow in Brazil. They have a lot of room to grow. And today, for example, just released a report that they are starting its second ethanol plant in Brazil. So it's a play that, let's say, they have the right strategy to play this sector in Brazil, and we like that this, given the level of valuation. We can discuss this further, but I want to close my initial remarks here. Sorry to be too long, but that's it.
Thank you, Gabriel. And before switching to Patrick, there's actually a client question on Brazil that me and you probably can divide and conquer. But the question is El Nino positive in terms of crop yields for Brazil producers of corn, soybean, sugarcane, cotton? My understanding is it's really the El Nino pattern will create a high level of precipitation typically in Brazil, but not equally everywhere. So it really depends on where it will fall. But historically, it's been more beneficial than less. I don't know if you have any color on that, Gabriel.
No, it's a good point. Depending on the region, right? It depends on the intensity of El Nino.
Right.
A really strong El Nino, for example, in the south region tends to be positive. A really strong, moderate El Nino, for example, tends to have more, let's say, precipitation, and it seems that be good for the south region of Brazil. However, in moments that you have a really, really strong El Nino, this could be quite bad for the south region in Brazil. With floods, for example, that we have seen in the past, let's say, occurrence of El Nino. So I think that the main point here is that the uncertainty that this creates are surrounding the productivity in Brazil. In the central region of Brazil, the precipitation tends to be more erratic, so it's hard to say if it be good or bad. During the SOC last conference call, for example, they are investing a lot in irrigation in Bahia. That's a state that they're growing a lot, but there is this kind of problem regarding the precipitation. So they tend to protect themselves investing in irrigation. In El Nino scenarios, this tends to increase the risk of productivity and the precipitation. So I think that the main point here is that I would say that a really intense El Nino tends to be negative. And when you put this into context and costs in the cost side, with producers tends to decrease their investment, given the how expensive it is, the crop season for the next, mainly for the next crop season, a lower investment together with this uncertainty in the weather, this could represent a more risk on the production for 2006-07.
And I appreciate all the questions that clients are sending to us, and it's actually quite a lot. So actually, if I can, one more for Gabriel again, just to stay on this topic. So we really haven't talked about BRL and its strengthening pattern. So the question is BRL stronger, better for farmers so fertilizer prices are cheap in BRL terms, or is weaker, better from the standpoint of receiving more BRL for exports? Really quick, if you can comment on that.
It's negative. But it's negative. Remember that the revenues, it's 100% pegged into dollars, right? So if when you think about commodity price, we should think about the companies here being in export companies. So strong BRL for farmers in Brazil tends to be negative overall, right? And there are some companies that are leveraging BRL. So BRL appreciating is not good for them. So okay. Reinvest, yeah, here, sense. It's a is negative.
Yeah. And do you see FMC orders in Brazil spiking over the last few weeks?
Yeah, I can take this one, and then I'm happy to be off a brief one. Yeah,
sure.
Look, so you know, ahead of their sort of earnings call, they felt they had line of sight into specifically their direct sales to Brazilian growers. Now they have a much stronger position with cotton, sugar, and to a lesser extent, coffee and other specialty crops, and they're starting to grow their corn and soybean position from a direct sales standpoint. They saw a pretty rapid acceleration from about a third of their orders committed 2 weeks ago to half of their orders committed versus previously anticipating half by the end of June. Now they're saying, you know, 70% of book sales in hand by the end of June. And I think that probably speaks to, you know, uncertainty on security of supply for crop chemicals. If there's going to be some sort of drop off of Chinese imports into the region, or, you know, potentially higher prices coming down the pipe. So it feels like there is some commitment to get ahead of that.
Thank you. Yeah. And Patrick, if any other, yeah, opening remarks on your coverage.
I'll make it relatively quick because I know we have a lot of questions. I think just for brief context on El Nino, you know, for our companies, you know, going back to the most recent events in 15, 16 and 23, 24, you know, in 16, you saw pretty strong negative results in Asia due to the poor weather conditions. But I think on the flip side, you know, general strength in the Americas, particularly North America. And, you know, as Gabriel mentioned before, it can be somewhat mixed, you know, just depending on the unevenness of the rainfall and dryness across from Brazil. And you know, planting delays, you know, with strong export demand and, you know, capturing some of the Chinese soybean demand from the U.S. So I think, you know, bottom line impact for both companies on the super El Nino risk would likely be negative for volumes in Asia, although those companies have generally shrinking positions at this point. You know, strong acreage potentially in Latin America, and likely, you know, potential positive conditions from both higher grain prices and favorable weather in North America. And, you know, maybe even in a more constructive angle, you know, extreme weather could also directly impact pest pressure, you know, emphasize the need for yield protection with, you know, technology products that Corteva and FMC offer. I'll just briefly give, you know, some context and data points on the Middle East conflict specific to crop chems. You know, I think, you know, we've seen corn and soy futures move up on a variety of different factors that we've, you know, already sort of previously mentioned, but, you know, fertilizer and other input costs, you know, potentially moving up in excess of that. You know, I think for North America specifically, the majority of nitrogen fertilizers were already pre-bought for this year's season. So we don't foresee a material impact on, you know, North American acreage shifts or yields at this point. But there could be longer term implications in the case of a prolonged conflict with any sort of cutback on applications or shift from corn to soy, you know, given the less nitrogen dependence. I think, as Gabriel mentioned, I think we see the potential acreage risk in 26 entering into 27, you know, from this input pressure as being more pronounced for Latin American productivity and farmer balance sheets. I'd say on the crop chem side, you know, we're still not calling for a massive inflection in generics pricing, you know, but positive data points in recent weeks have included higher Chinese pricing, you know, reduced exports and higher Brazil energy prices prompting some price response. And while we've seen some benchmark prices like glyphosate move up 40% since the conflict began, and we could see some impact in overall application rates in the second half, you know, I think this is more likely a 2027 story, just given where channel inventories sit and, you know, the length of the supply chain at this point. You know, that said, I think overall impact on our coverage, we expect commodity, energy, raw material cost inflation to have a larger impact on 2027 results, but likely slightly net positive for U.S.-based crop chemical companies, you know, given their regional mix at this point. So generally see bullish risk to corn and soybean from both higher inputs and potential weather patterns to be the largest upside for North American growers, and we expect it to be the biggest, you know, potential tailwind for Corteva's seed business. So, you know, generally we remain neutral across the group given the uncertainty and input cost pressures, you know, grain prices having not seen a large enough response yet. You know, we also note that both companies are undergoing large transformations, and, you know, we have skepticism in FMC's case on the pace of the pace and potential dilution of its deleveraging efforts and the implied valuation levels for Corteva's seed business. So I'll make it brief here and I'll pass it on because I know we've got a lot of questions in the queue. I think Seb maybe has some.
Thank you, Patrick. Yep. Sebastian?
Sure. Hi, everyone. And thanks for having me on the call. I'm just going to comment on our views on fertilizers. Well, obviously, the Middle East conflict is super topical at the moment and what that means for our European coverage as well. Now, it's already been commented upon multiple times. Prices for fertilizers are up a lot. They're not as high yet as they were in 22, but not that far below. And clearly that is because of the major supply disruption that we have from the Strait of Hormuz. Particularly true for nitrogen, and about a third of the global traded urea is coming out of the Middle East. And therefore prices are now about 100% above where they were on their past 10-year average. Phosphate prices are also up a lot. Here the issues are sulfur and ammonia. It's less the case for potash, and I'll address that in a minute. I'm also not going to focus too much on phosphates because it doesn't really matter too much for European coverage here. If I talk a little bit about nitrogen first, just from a very simple high-level perspective, the urea market is more disrupted than the natural gas market. Right, and natural gas is the main raw material. So that's, if you wish, supportive to both prices and producer margins as well. Now, the big issue, obviously, is that farmer profits were already quite low heading into this crisis, right? And now they're being squeezed even more. Now, the crisis started right at the beginning of the application season in the Northern Hemisphere. So, I mean, some of the contracts had already been agreed, but there's also not that much that farmers could do to begin with. And particularly because demand for nitrogen fertilizers is less elastic. And if you don't apply it, you risk ruining your yield. However, at the same time, there's also a diminished rate of returns. So the optimal rate of application has already started to decline. So just to give you the example of European winter wheat, it's something like 9% lower. And correspondingly, we've seen also a 5 to 10% decline in nitrogen imports into Europe. So we are seeing less demand, and that is consistent. Right? You somehow need to, if there's less supply, you somehow need to balance supply and demand. Now, what in the moment moving out of the application season in the Northern Hemisphere, and we are starting to see prices rolling over recently. That's not uncommon at that time of the year. I think producers would want to incentivize their farmers to pre-buy. But with prices as high as they are, there's probably relatively little incentive to do so at this point. So therefore, there is at least a risk of some so-called demand destruction. And how swiftly things normalize if the strait opens is really difficult to say at this point. To be fair, we're not really aware of massive, major kind of sustainable damage to urea plants. But again, how swiftly prices then would revert, we don't really know at that point. Nonetheless, we did downgrade Yara to neutral last week. Yara is the largest global nitrogen producer. Just think that risk reward here is more balanced now. We only see upside to consensus in a scenario where the Strait of Hormuz remains closed for a prolonged period of time. So from that perspective, it functions as a pretty good hedge. But if we look at valuation, I mean, on the headline multiple, super cheap, 4x EBITDA. But also we need to bear in mind the company is materially over-earning. If we look at a more normalized mid-cycle EBITDA, the stock's trading on something like 6x, and that's more in line with historic average. So we fear that any further upgrades would probably be derated. But nonetheless, it probably does work well as a hedge against the prolonged closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Moving over briefly to potash, which is a bit an interesting setup, actually. It's not really as distorted. There's limited capacity in the Middle East, and therefore prices also haven't shot up in the same way. And that makes potash actually by far the most affordable among the key ingredients, so nutrients. At the same time, it's also probably the most discretionary. farmers can skip a season without having to accept really massively negative ramifications on their yields. However, they've done so already, or many of them have already done so after the Ukraine war. So it's a bit difficult to say how high the need to apply potash is at this point. What we see for the time being is that prices are moving up, and that indicates that demand remains reasonably strong. And that's something that we heard also. We had our European chemicals conference yesterday, and we had the management of K&S presenting there. And that's probably one of the key takeaways. Demand for potash is still looking really good. With that setup, what does it mean for the stock itself, which is one of the larger listed European potash producers? They had already positively pre-released, raised the guidance. To be fair, that was mostly on their salt business and a strong cold winter over here. But given the positive trajectory that we're seeing in potash prices, they also produce a lot of so-called specialties, which require sulfur. If you wish, backward integrated into sulfur, that they should see continued positive earnings momentum. And accordingly, it is one of the best health stocks in our coverage among investors. So a bit more concerned, just given how well the shares have already done and the more discretionary nature of potash, which is why we're on the sideline. I leave it here and happy to give it back to you.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you, Sebastian. And actually, a follow-up really quick to one of the things that you mentioned, Sebastian. So the question the client has is, what do you estimate will the impact be if Europe gives bailout payments or emergency subsidies to farmers over the next 12 months? And then also, if they build up strategic stockpiles, as considerations were reported overnight, what additional demand could be seen by Yara and other nitrogen producers? Do you have any insights there?
Yeah, I mean, very short high-level answer would be clearly supportive, because farmer affordability is one of the big risks that investors and also the company is worried about. So therefore, it is something that I think would be broadly supportive. And there's another discussion which goes in a similar direction, which is according to CBAM, which also has come into effect this year in Europe, again, at a point in time.
请关注公众号,思维纪要社, 更多纪要请加V, CN202101130.
When prices for fertilizers are moving up, so there are some discussions around that as well. But here the expectation would be that it remains in place. At least it's unlikely it would be kind of suspended without doing anything on the carbon price that Yara has to pay at this point. The view has always been, take the CBAM and support the farmers to make fertilizers more affordable for the domestic farmer. But yeah, kind of long story short, it would be definitely something that would be super supportive to domestic demand.
Okay, understood. Thank you. And there is a question, I guess, to me about India. India gets subsidized, so farmers will be less sensitive to high prices. And that's true. That's correct. In India, if we're talking about sugar, I understand. In India, farmers have been increasing, acreage and, planting more sugar cane. However, what's been happening is even this season, India expected to have a bumper crop. The expectations were some analysts were expecting 34 million metric tons. India ended up, this season with 28 million metric ton, which pretty much on the par with the consumption. And it's partly attributed to the lower yields and relatively bad weather. So they're less price sensitive in that regard. And that's a correct statement, because there's a lot of subsidies and there's domestic price on sugar in India than Brazil. But there's this weather implications actually have a big play there. Another question there is on to what degree, and I combined because there are several of those, to what degree can better yields in the U.S. Due to the typically positive El Nino effects offset reduced fertilizer application? And then the similar question is, what does base case El Nino conditions mean for grain prices, corn, soy, wheat? I don't know if Patrick, you have any views about this, but
yeah.
In general, yeah, maybe maybe let me start just to kind of from the commodities standpoint, right? In general, if we look historically at the, all the precedents of the El Nino, the yields were beneficial and were better off. Now we did not have the similar risk with the under applying fertilizers. Even during 2022, when the fertilizer prices increased, those availability was still there. So again, not so much relevant for the US probably, but more for Brazil and others. I don't know, Patrick, if you have similar
view. I think it's still the fertilizer application is going to be just generally overwhelmed by, you know, the affordability math in terms of the disconnect between inputs and grain prices. And even, you know, there's probably some complementary nature, modest sort of correlation between favorable weather conditions and increased fertilizer application rates because you have better productivity, better, you know, efficiency. But, you know, on the flip side, the sort of extreme weather event, you know, reduces the efficiency and there may be more application or deferred application. So unfortunately, it's not as much of a clean story, I would say. But, you know, overall, I think that the fertilizer dynamics are going to be relatively distinct from that.
I agree on that. And then another client question is, could the severity of El Nino be felt in other regions as well, such as Africa, South Africa? And I can take on that. Yes, absolutely. El Nino, or even strong El Nino, provides is the dry spell across Africa, so with a low level of precipitation. And that was very observant in 23-24 when we had not only low level of precipitations, but also very strong dry Harmattan winds that knocked out the cocoa trees. And so that's where I expect kind of the expectation for cocoa to be highly exposed to this strong El Nino is coming from. Another question, just curious, hasn't the fertilizer been mostly ordered and utilized last year for current season's grains, for example, corn? The current inflated fertilizer prices can only impact mostly on next year's plant season. Then how much the current fertilizer price could impact the grain prices projection in the report? And I can also take on that, but if anyone on the panel has any views, please share those. But that's broadly correct. Now, the risk that I see from the high fertilizer prices currently playing out is the shortage in other areas in Brazil, undersupplying, and in Europe, in India, and other parts of the world, which will create a higher pool for CBOT and probably higher demand, and that will, in my assessment, increase the prices. Now, true, it's mostly impactful for the next year, and depending on how long the strait stays closed and how long the elevated prices on fertilizers will stay. But if the fertilizer prices in general represent about 50% of the variable cost for U.S. farmers for corn and soy, and when the prices are not increasing by 50%, or equivalent to what the fertilizer increase is, then you will see the squeeze in the profit margins of the farmers, which will be incentivized to save up and probably apply less. So this is one of the scenarios that I have at the moment. I don't know if others on the panel have any views about that. If not, we can move forward. So, there's a question on the ethanol. So how does corn factor into the weakening ethanol economics? Does weakening profitability mean that Brazilian mills shift to sugar production instead of ethanol, and ethanol production shifts to corn feedstock instead of sugar? I don't know. Gabriel, do you have any views there? You've done that report.
These are really complex equation, right? I think that in terms of corn ethanol, we expect a huge increase this year, right? And I think that these are a kind of independent variable from sugar and ethanol players, right? So I think that the main point here, if you take a look on the ethanol profitability and you compare with corn ethanol profitability with sugarcane ethanol profitability, corn ethanol costs, I don't know, 20, 15% less to be produced than sugarcane ethanol. So I think that the trend right now is that corn ethanol is going to gain share from sugarcane ethanol. The main point right now is that demand is growing in Brazil. So as demand grows, they are going to absorb a good, let's say a large part of this higher ethanol production, which means we forecast here something close to 1.5 billion liters additional supply of corn ethanol this crop season. So it's kind of balanced. The main question mark is how the mix on sugarcane ethanol is going to behave. So in the beginning of the crop season, what happens is that most of the players have moved towards ethanol production, given first the profitability that was higher than sugar. And second, there is a kind of strategy, commercialization strategy, is that ethanol tends to be transformed into cash faster than sugar. So most of the players that they are in a tough position, tough economic position, they tend to increase the ethanol production at the beginning of the crop season in order to monetize this ethanol faster than sugar. But right now, the main question mark is, okay, ethanol is almost the same level of sugar. So depending on how sugar behave, given all of the factors that Arkady mentioned about the potential tightness of the sector in the next few months, given all of the projects that we have on El Nino, and depending on how gasoline price is going to behave, things could change drastically, right? So what's important to pay attention right now? It's how gasoline price is going to trend. If it trend higher, it would be positive for ethanol, so we can increase again ethanol production. Or if sugar starts to perform better, it's also important to remember that the level of hedge for sugar producers in Brazil, it's on the lowest level, the historical level. So they have more flexibility here to produce more sugar. And most of those sugar and ethanol players, they have increased their investment in order to increase their flexibility to produce more sugar. So there is more flexibility in the market today, but all of this depends on how gasoline price is going to perform as a consequence ethanol impact, how the ethanol profitability is going to impact. I wanted to add one additional point that I forgot to mention here that's quite important. I think that for all the sector that we are discussing here is the level of leverage that producers in Brazil are now today in Brazil, right? So interest rates in Brazil are too high. They're too leveraged. So the capacity to invest, it's not only the sugar and ethanol business, but in all of the sectors in the farm business, right? We are seeing a lot of discussion about the credit, healthy in Brazil and how leveraged are the producers in Brazil. So the capacity to invest in Brazil is lower than in the past because of this level of indebtedness that we are seeing from farmers in Brazil. So these together with low profitability, with higher interest rates in Brazil, is not a good scenario for investment. This is something to pay attention on this impact on the productivity for 2026-2027.
Makes sense. Yeah. Thank you. There's a really good question that I'm not sure what's the answer. So is the strong El Nino bullish or bearish for global fertilizer demand? How do you weigh the higher commodity price versus potential for lower planting? And do you anticipate a change in Brazilian acreage under a strong El Nino? Anyone on the panel have any views? I mean, Sebastian, probably you.
I must admit, the disruption of the Strait of Hormuz is such an overriding theme at the moment that it hasn't really featured much in the discussions. So this is kind of a way of not answering, but I think if you look, the relevance of the supply disruption, what's happening to input costs, etc., is likely going to be the main driver for fertilizer prices for the kind of foreseeable 12 months or so. So therefore, I think it hasn't been flagged as a major. I think you can read it in either direction, but historically, it's not something that has really had a massive impact on fertilizer demand from our perspective.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. And there was a related question as well, so hopefully that answered that. Let me move back. So is there sufficient spare capacity of corn, sugar, soybean crush, and biofuel production facilities to cater to the biofuels push, or are they already close to max capacity? So if we're talking about the U.S., there is a capacity, available capacity on the crush. So EPA recently announced about the increase of the biomass-based diesel, which is beneficial for soybeans. On the ethanol side, the production, when we look at track on the weekly data from the EIA, production of ethanol has been increasing year over year. So there is a capacity outstanding that would allow and to increase that scale. The next question is, how are grain farmers, specifically in AM, responding to higher fertilizer prices? I don't know, Seb, if you have any insights over there, or if not.
No, I think the point I made is currently we're out of season mostly, right? So what you are seeing is that we've had an extremely high price paid for in India. I think one of the highest we've seen in a long time. And we probably may see additional tenders, but no one else is kind of willing to pay those type of prices. Now, India is being, the bill is being subsidized, so therefore it's less impacting the farmer itself. In the other regions, I think Brazil, we've started to see prices start to roll over and we're still a little bit ahead of the season. So from that perspective, we're seeing prices starting to roll over a little bit just because of what I mentioned. Optimal application rates having started to come down a bit.
Makes sense. And then there is a question about wheat, which we haven't really discussed. So given that wheat production is more diversified geographically than corn, soybeans, do any regions benefit from El Nino enough to offset losses in other regions, U.S., Australia, Canada, and Black Sea, all appear to be negatively impacted? I would say that that's correct. The wheat market is much more diversified and more spread out. And it's really hard to actually quantify the loss and what will be the next impact, because obviously warmer winters during the El Nino will be beneficial for wheat markets. We saw what happened with this crop, right, and where the regrading has been happening because of the really cold winter that we observed in the U.S. So I do think that this will be beneficial for the U.S. and Canada as well. However, Australia and Black Sea those regions would be probably more exposed, but it's not that clear of the pattern, I would say. So if anything, I would characterize wheat to be the least exposed agricultural commodity to the El Nino implications and plays. The next question is about El Nino as well. So lots of gloom and doom out there on El Nino and comparisons to 1970s. How concerned are you? I know you said 60% odds of strong El Nino. I'm trying to think about food shortages, inflation spike risks, etc. I will comment on that, because what we see currently, I think it's important to rely on the factual data, and especially when we talk about weather, because the forecast beyond 14 days is really a scenario, a probabilistic scenario that could play out. But what we've seen now is that the Pacific, the temperatures in the Pacific are the warmest ever for this specific period of the year. So if we compare the temperatures that were in the Pacific on the sea surface level in 2015, and that was the latest strong El Nino, and even 1970s, right now we are at the warmest, one of the warmest stages ever historically observed. This is super concerning. This shows that this system is developing much faster. Now, would it stop there stay to be mild? Potentially, that's a scenario. That's a 20% probability that NOAA is assigning, right? But the fact that it's happening so early in the season, in the period, it's more likely to progress and more likely to develop in the stronger El Nino. So the 1970s example is not a good comparison point in my view, because since then we advanced a lot in the fertilizer application. We advanced a lot in the technologies on the modern farming, which would allow us to kind of limit that exposure. So I do think that 2015, 2016 is actually a better comparison in this case, kind of a reference point of where we were. Now, if the record El Nino will materialize and severe weather patterns will emerge, it's really hard to predict what kind of implications, as we've been saying, right, will that carry for majority of the ag commodities. While some of them are exposed more, some of them are exposed less, the risk of the hurricanes, of the typhoons, of the extreme weather patterns is still there. And that's something that potentially could have an idiosyncratic risk, right, depending on whether it's hitting the areas where your main coffee plantations are or soybean area growing is happening. So all of that really becomes very isolated, right? On the macro side, as we presented in the beginning, typically it's higher level of precipitation in South America and sort of droughtness in West Africa and in India and other regions. So with that, we're coming on the top of the hour, and we believe addressed majority of the questions. If there are still any questions outstanding that you would like us to cover, please feel free to send me an email we'll make sure that this is addressed and answered. But with that, let me thank you, Gabriel, Patrick, Sebastian. Very insightful call. I learned a lot, and let's continue tracking these developments, as obviously those risks are appearing to a different degree and weighing on the price action for different agricultural commodities. So it's really important to keep that in mind. Thank you for that, and I would like to end the call on that.